This is Kids These Days.
Today on Kids These Days, we're talking about the stress caregivers can feel when the health and safety of others is something they're responsible for. I'm Sarah Gonzalez, and joining me in the studio today are three guests who will discuss the challenges caregivers face when caring for family members who are aging, chronically ill, or mentally ill. Also this hour, we report on how stress affects our children, and we find out what it means to be part of the sandwich generation, or that growing population of people who are caring for aging parents while also raising their own children. That and more this hour on Kids These Days. Hi, I'm Sarah Gonzalez, sitting in today for Shanna Sheehy. On this program, we talk about issues of interest to caregivers raising children. And children doesn't always mean young kids under the age of 20. Everybody is someone's child, and everyone is part of a family. Caring for family members is a reality for people of all ages. It's not an easy job, either. There is much emotion wrapped up in seeing to the everyday needs of someone that you love. Today, we'll be looking at the issue of caregiver stress from three different angles that families who take care of other family members might face: caring for the chronically ill, caring for aging parents, and caring for a mentally ill family member. We'll explore the unique challenges faced by every age of caregiver and what helps these caregivers to cope and take care of themselves. Are you a caregiver at the moment? What challenges are you facing? Kids These Days wants to know. Email us now. That's mail at kidsthesedays.org, or leave a comment on today's story, which is posted on the website right now. Today with me in the studio to talk more about the stresses caregivers can face are Gary Barg. He has dedicated the last 15 years of his life to being the caregiver of caregivers. In 1995, he founded Today's Caregiver Magazine as a source of information and support for others caring for aging relatives. In addition to this magazine, he founded caregiver.com and began a series of events called Fearless Caregiver Conferences, which are held across the nation. Gary Barg also wrote the award-winning book, The Fearless Caregiver. He joins us today by phone from Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Gary, thanks for being part of this discussion.
I'm looking forward to it. Thank you for inviting me.
Certainly. And in the studio with me today are two guests. Sandy Kern, she is a program developer and manager for oncology support services at Providence, Alaska Medical Center. She oversees the Susan Butcher Family Center, the Healing Arts Program, and the clinical support groups. Sandy has 25 years of experience teaching and providing educational and social work programs. Part of her work is to facilitate support groups for families who are caregivers to cancer patients. Thank you for joining us today, Sandy.
Thanks for having us.
And last but certainly not least is Francine Harbor. She is the executive director of the Anchorage affiliate of the National Alliance on Mental Illness. She is a teacher and teacher trainer for the NAMI Family to Family class, a free 12-week class where family members come together to learn about mental illness so they can take better care of their ill relatives and themselves. Francine is a family member herself of relatives with mental illness, as well as a person in recovery from mental illness. She has been involved with NAMI Anchorage for almost 10 years. Welcome, Francine.
Thank you for the opportunity to share. Appreciate it.
Well, we're glad that you can all join us today to talk about caregiver stress. And this is really personal work that each of you are doing. And supporting those who are caring for family members who are ill is a pretty heavy job that you are all involved in. I think to start, I'd love to hear a little bit about how each of you became interested in supporting caregivers. Gary, can we start with you? How did you become involved in caring for caregivers of the aging?
Well, I'll say that I generally, my conversation is that I get involved the hard way. I was a video producer in Atlanta getting set up for the 96 Olympics. It was 1994. My dad had retired in 90, passed away in 91. My grandmother was sick. My grandfather was sick. And so mom was, you know, family caregiver of record. And the summer of 94, I had a two-week period I could go down and spend some time with her. And I thought I would just, you know, give her support and look over the books. And I'll tell you, it was the most intense and painful and life and death questions and answers constantly being, you know, thrown at us that I ever went through in that two-week period. And I sat with her right before I was going to leave and go back to Atlanta and continue my life. And I said, Mom, I'm so glad I got involved with you right now. I helped you out. Had 2 weeks to care for you, you know, to help you out. And she said, I don't understand. I'm confused. Because to her, it was a normal two-week period in a life of a family caregiver. So I gave up everything I was doing, and I came back to support her to be a caregiver's caregiver. Mm-hmm. And as I traveled around and helping my family out, I saw a lot of other families who needed support, and we just took it on as a family role. We started today's Caregiver Magazine, caregiver.com, and hosting the Fearless Caregiver Conferences.
Were you interested in founding the magazine and the conferences because you felt like there weren't enough resources for people who were in your position?
Frankly, we needed it. I thought I would find it. I mean, this is pre-internet days, and I walked around to bookstores and I in and out of different organizations, and I kept looking for the Caregiver Magazine. There had to be one, and it just became a mission for us. Once we couldn't find one, is to put together the information we needed as family caregivers, and it took off from there. And once the internet, you know, exploded, and we got caregiver.com in 1995. It made the support we were able to give national and international.
Sandy, you have a long history, over 25 years of working with the population of families that you work with. How did you become involved in your work with families facing cancer?
As we work with cancer patients, we know that they need that well-rounded support. We know that they need those resources in order to shore up, to be able to handle what the disease is providing them every day, the different challenges. And so as part of just really good clinical social work, you always want to offer support groups and resources. It began to become very personal to me over the last few years, though, as I watched my aunts caring for my grandmother. And then I watched my mother care for her father and then her mother. And then a year ago, it really got personal when my sister was diagnosed with cancer and relocated to Alaska to live with me, and I became her caregiver. So now not only was I responsible for helping coordinate and work with the team of social workers and nurses and chaplains providing resources to our families, I now was in need of that same service. And during that time in trying to work and provide care for my own family member, I, of course, did not avail myself of any of the caregiving resources. I just trudged through, and now, a year later, am coming back to pick up the pieces and really take a look at, oh my goodness, how could we do better for the caregivers? Now that once you've experienced something firsthand, it's very different than what you might read in a textbook.
Do you feel that your personal experience then has helped you be better at your job? And are there things that you learned as a caregiver that you just maybe had no idea before?
Absolutely. I didn't realize how hard it is to ask for help. Sometimes you're so overwhelmed, you don't even ask for help for yourself. You just kind of put your head down and then just do what needs to be done until you really feel quite burdened.
Mm. And Francine, tell us about how you became interested in supporting families who are coping with a mentally ill family member.
Well, I can tell you that it was not anything I expected to ever do. Having grown up from being the very youngest of children of two parents who were mentally ill and an older sister that was mentally ill, the last thing I wanted to do, I ever expected to do, was have anything to do with mental illness again. My dad had undiagnosed bipolar disorder. I'm not sure if my mom was ever diagnosed or not, but she had severe depression with psychosis. My older sister had a bad personality disorder, and it was a very abusive family. And so from the youngest period of time, I not only was the, quote, victim of inappropriate behavior from people who had the severe illness, but I became the caregiver of my mom from a very young age. You know, I remember making her coffee so she could get up in the morning to go to school. She was a teacher. So basically, as soon as I had an opportunity to leave the family, I did. Then what happened in 88, I finally had my symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder became so severe that I started counseling myself and started this long road to recovery for myself, was eventually diagnosed with bipolar myself, mm-hmm. And very luckily found NAMI, mm-hmm. Started as what we call a consumer of mental health services, being the individual who needed support, and came to realize that there were family members out there who needed the support just as well. So I made it my mission at that point to pull, NAMI has a 20-year history of supporting family members who are taking care of mentally ill relatives. And I made it a point just to become involved with the family movement as well as the consumer movement. And it has helped me understand my own family better than any counseling I ever went to.
So you find that the family-to-family, like the peer support model, is really valuable.
Right. It's as valuable as professional counseling is. When you have been in the same shoes as the people who you are helping, they finally can have a sigh of relief and go, oh, somebody else understands. Mm-hmm. Oh, I can actually talk to somebody. I don't have to live in silence anymore. I don't have to be ashamed anymore. I don't have to feel guilty because all I want to do is wring my family member's neck mm-hmm. because I am so fed up with you know, his or her behavior. Mm-hmm. And to be able to be very honest from the heart about what these feelings that we're not supposed to have because mm-hmm. we're supposed to love our relatives, and then move beyond that. Mm-hmm. Learn how to cope with that and learn how to care for ourselves so we can have compassion towards our relatives on a more regular basis.
Mm-hmm. This is Kids These Days. Today's conversation is about coping with caregiver stress. I'm Sarah Gonzalez, your host today, and I'm talking with Francine Harbor, Sandy Kearns, and Gary Barg, three professionals who've devoted their careers to caring for caregivers. Gary, tell us what someone who is experiencing caregiver stress may be going through. What does it look like, and how does it manifest?
Well, the challenge is that so much of this is insidious, where we isolate ourselves as family caregivers so other people don't see us go through it, and it comes upon us, unfortunately, you know, kind of slow. We feel tired. Mm-hmm. We feel overwhelmed. We're not sleeping, or we're sleeping too much. We're eating a lot or eating a little. You know, we lose interest. We can barely, you know, move ourselves around during the day. And the greatest challenge is for caregivers going through stress is that we always feel we're the only ones going through it. Nobody gets what we're going through, and nobody's there to help us until we reach out into the communities, you know, and find Francine and Sandy's groups and the different organizations, NAMI, and we find that we're not alone, and all of a sudden it really makes a great difference to the stress that we face. Caregiver stress is, I think, one of the greatest challenges we face to be able to help our loved ones and help ourselves too.
Is it possible to be a caregiver and avoid the stress? Is it just something that you will expect to experience and learn how to get through? Sandy?
I think that you really don't know what's happening to you at the time you're going through it. And so you just kind of shore up and try and do the best that you can. And like Gary said, you then begin to just wear down and you become very, very tired. And it is something that's not really talked about. I specialize in working with the children of adults with cancer. And so I'd like to comment on their peer support. I'd like to talk about their shame that they have of having someone at home that is sick.
Yeah, tell us more about that.
Yeah, they may be missing school. They may be doing very poor academically or socially, but they're not letting their peers know, hey, my mom has cancer, or my dad hasn't worked in several months and we're not able to, you know, pay our monthly bills. We have been privilege to go into the school district and run support groups for children who have a parent living with cancer. And what we find in those groups is those children then begin to own up to why they've not been at school, why there's excessive absences, why there's bullying, why there's teasing. All these other behaviors that are happening are actually coming because the child may have been a primary caregiver left alone at home, providing the medication for a parent, going with them to doctor's appointments, all at the cost of their own childhood.
And Francine, you said that you were actually a caregiver when you were a child,
right,
in your family. And it right. sounds like you became the caregiver by default almost.
Yes.
And
yes.
How was that experience for you? Where
well,
did you find support?
My dad chose to basically absent himself. He wasn't around, so he wasn't there to support my mother and her illness, probably too preoccupied with his own situation. You know, children, when they have an ill relative, they start taking certain roles on. So I took on the caregiver role. I was the, quote, good child, you know, the golden child. And my older sister was the troublemaker. And my younger brother was the silent child. And so I became my mother's caregiver in the sense of when she couldn't cook meals. So I would cook very basic meals, you know, what are they called? The kind of steaks, minute steaks, you know, that and hamburgers and, you know, pot pies. And she would need help waking. She used alcohol to deal with her symptoms, which is very common. And so I'd always go to the liquor store with her and help her, you know, make sure she remembered the things that she always got. One thing that's often not talked about when children become caregivers is that if the ill relative is very lonely, you know, sometimes in a physical comfort way, and there can be that kind of very inappropriate, quote-unquote, intimacy that happens. Mm-hmm. If someone gets so severely ill that they, even if it's an illness like cancer or some other illness, often a depression will set in or some other type of mental illness. So caregiver burden can not only be doing the kind of objective day-to-day things, like going to appointments and things like making meals for the ill relative, but there can be a very inappropriate, you know, substituting for the significant other who may be absent in the ill person's life. And you certainly, as a child, don't ever talk about those things.
Sure. So it sounds like there's a lot of shame associated with caregiver, being a caregiver. Maybe so much of it happens at home behind closed doors in bedrooms where there's someone sick and it's keeping you away from a community, from the outside
right.
world. And it seems like, you know, how do you draw those people out and get them to come to your groups and reach out to them?
And the number one way we help people is outreach. We have to get the word out that we're there. And then once people know that we're there, we have to gently coax them in and let them know that it's safe mm-hmm. to come to us in the first place, and then it's safe to start to talk to us. We've had people drop into our NAMI building, and it's like they won't leave the front counter. Mm-hmm. And then we kind of get them downstairs where it's private. And then they start talking about, you know, maybe safe things to talk about, and then they start getting into the story, and the tears mm-hmm. come, and the anger comes, and the sense of, you know, guilt and frustration finally comes up. And we spend an hour and a half sitting with total strangers because mm-hmm. they haven't had a chance to tell anybody their story yet because they've been so isolated because of that sense that I'm the only one going through this. I'm sure there's no one else out there who is dealing with what I'm dealing with.
I absolutely agree. I think that is a terrific point. We host a series of conferences around the country. We just did our 105th called Fearless Caregiver Conferences. And how we do it is the same way. We try to go through their trusted authorities, you know, their doctors and their friends and the people who identify them as caregivers even when they don't identify themselves. And I remember a few years ago, a gentleman walked into the front door of our conference in Philly, and boy, his fists were clenched and his face was red. He said, "My wife's doctor said I needed to be here," but he didn't seem happy about it. And so The morning session is, I call a big support group, maybe 400 people, and I run around with a microphone trying to get people to open up, ask questions, interact. And he called me over, and his face was still red. And I thought, okay, this is where I get punched, you know. And I came over to him, and he was actually crying. Mm-hmm. Big, tough guy. He was actually crying because he was hearing his story coming out of other people's mouths. Mm-hmm. And like you said, he stayed, you know, we stayed and had a little smaller support group for like 2 hours after the entire conference was over. So, yeah, absolutely. They have to see themselves, recognize themselves, and then share their story with others.
Today on Kids These Days, we're talking about caregiver stress, the stress of being the parent or the person in charge. Parents may not always realize just how much the way in which they handle stress, or don't handle it, is being observed and absorbed by their children. The Early Life Stress Research Program at Stanford University studies kids and stress and tries to develop methods to help kids who have been in stressful situations become more resilient. Current research is working in San Francisco Bay Area schools with kids who have been involved with or witnessed interpersonal violence, teaching them methods to deal with the trauma and the reminders of that trauma that pop up in everyday life. KTD contributor Jessica Cochran spoke with senior therapist Halit Kletter.
When you're looking at how kids respond to stress, what different factors are you looking at?
We look at a variety of different factors. We look at how is it impacting their social functioning, how is it impacting their academics, how is it impacting their overall well-being. Stress can affect physical health. It can affect emotional health. So we look at all these things. We look at functioning within the family. So what are the, how is the environment impacting the child's stress levels? And we look at what factors, what strengths does a child have in being able to handle this stress? And what risk factors are there? Really, the idea is to be able to maximize upon the strengths and teach the kids skills for being able to enhance their capacity to cope with stress.
And so when you're looking at those strengths, are is that individual to each child that you work with, or are there some things that children generally tend to have as strengths in these situations?
Right. It varies from child to child, really. There are several factors that are going to affect how a child is able to handle stress. One is just, you know, how much the cumulative load. Each of us has a different stress threshold, and each of us also interprets how we're impacted by the events that happen in our lives in a different way. So you can have two kids exposed to the exact same experience, and one won't be affected and the other will be, you know, significantly impacted. It's dependent on the child's temperament. It's dependent on what kind of coping skills they have and resources. And one major key factor that we see is social support. Just having one person in the child's life that cares and is there to offer support, whether a primary caregiver, a teacher, a mentor, somebody the kid looks up to, is a very significant factor in their ability to cope with stress.
Okay. So you're really looking at each case individually, not each child individually when you're working?
Stress is very much an individual thing. And we're finding, and actually research in the area is moving more and more towards an individual approach, because each case is different. You can't make generalizations across the board that, you know, if a kid has had this experience, these are the factors that will help them out. It really depends on the individual.
When you're working with children, do you usually see reactions to this, you know, if someone's witnessed a violent reaction, do you see that response immediately, or does it sometimes take a while to emerge?
Yes, it can take a while to emerge. It can, you know, we've seen cases where they don't develop symptoms until half a year later. It really, again, depends individually on each child. Some children will develop symptoms right away. Others, it takes time for it to sink in or sort of process, and you'll notice the problems arising later on. It also depends on the developmental level and the meaning. So, for example, a child can undergo a stressful experience and not be impacted, say, but later on, you know, when they reach a critical age, say the teenage years, and they're forming their identity and trying to figure out who they are, maybe, you know, issues from that past experience might come up at that point. So just because they're not developing symptoms immediately doesn't mean that, you know, you shouldn't be looking out for the future. And we know that when symptoms go untreated, these kids tend to do worse.
And so in a situation where maybe someone doesn't appear to have an immediate reaction, would you wait until they do seem to have a reaction to treat it, or would you just start before that?
Right. The key thing to be looking for is impairment and functioning. So it's very normal. All of us are impacted by stress. It's very normal. There's a wide range of reactions. Anything from having bad dreams to trouble concentrating to feeling a little more irritable or angry. These are all common signs of stress, and we've all experienced them at one point or another. When it starts to get worrisome is when it's impacting functioning. So if you're noticing that, you know, all of a sudden your kid used to do okay in school, but now they're doing poorly and the teacher is, you know, commenting that they're concerned, that's a worry. If you're noticing that there's been a change in how they're interacting, either with family members or with their peers or other adults, that's a concern. Any change that really deviates from the normal behavior and that is distressing enough either for the individual or that others are starting to notice it.
So that's when you need to intervene.
So that's when you would intervene, exactly.
Okay. And so I had asked in my email, I think, you know, you're in looking at this work with kids exposed to violence, that to me that feels like a, you know, sort of acute, serious thing that these kids are dealing with. And I had asked a little bit about sort of more general stress from tough academics or getting into college, that kind of stress that's maybe not as acute, but perhaps more prolonged.
Right. It can actually, you know, depending again on the individual, it can affect them in similar ways, depending on the buildup of the stress. You know, for kids, certain kids that are in high school that are taking all AP classes and have all these extracurricular activities and have tremendous pressure on them to succeed, that might be a really traumatic experience for them. Not to compare that to, you know, the type of traumas that we're seeing with these kids exposed to interpersonal violence, but for that kid, that's major stress, right, from their perspective. And it might be overwhelming to even contemplate coping with that. How we work with these kids might be a little different because we're not targeting traumatic reminders. We're working more on teaching them coping skills for how can they handle all these pressures. What are strategies for getting through the, you know, school, for managing college applications and the SATs and all their classes? What is good self-care? And again, looking at what strengths do they have and how can we enhance their coping skills. So the idea is the same. The level might be slightly different.
Was there anything else that you want to tell me about the work that you're doing?
The work that we're doing, we're seeing a tremendous impact. Really, one of the major things in terms of stress in general is just education. Bringing it out to the public is a really huge thing, making people aware. Because a lot of times, and especially these days, kids have a lot more pressure placed on them and a lot more stress to succeed, to do well, and have all these expectations. And it might seem the norm for us, especially in a society where we're used to, you know, doing well. Work at Stanford, so here in the Bay Area, there's sort of, you know, this joke that kids graduate from high school and cross the street and go straight to Stanford. That's tremendous pressure to be placing on these kids. And so what we're looking at is what are ways that we can promote resiliency in these kids to be able to tolerate the stressors that are occurring in their lives. And also what are ways that we can enhance support from their families, support from the community.
Halit Kletter is lab director and senior therapist at Stanford University's Early Life Stress Program. She spoke with Kids These Days contributor Jessica Cochran. This is Kids These Days. I'm Sarah Gonzalez, your host today. We'll continue our conversation with our KTD in-studio guests, Francine Harbor, Sandy Kearns, and Gary Barg, after a quick break. Also coming up in the second half of the show, we'll learn about the sandwich generation and the special challenges those families face. Stay with us.
This is why I always wonder. I'm a pond full of regrets. Try to not remember rather than forget. This is why I always whisper when vagabonds are passing by. I tend to keep myself away from their goodbyes. The tide will rise and fall along the bay, and I am not going anywhere. I'm not going anywhere. People come and go and walk away, but I am not going anywhere. I am not going anywhere. This is why I always whisper. I'm a river with a spell. I like to hear but not to listen, like to say but not to tell.
It's a fact that families in Alaska love to spend time outdoors together, whether it's kayaking, hiking, picking berries, taking a caribou, or landing a record salmon. Families in the last frontier are all well-versed in many outdoor sporting activities. That's our focus next time on Kids These Days, families who hunt, fish, and gather together as a fresh air activity, as a subsistence way of life, or both. Celebrated Alaskan author of Ordinary Wolves and Shopping for Porcupine, Seth Kampner is on the program, and we'll hear about how the Department of Fish and Game is supporting Alaska's youth with their many outdoor sporting educational programs. Also on, we'll meet a family who hunts together, and we'll hear what the hunting-gathering lifestyle means to a community on Lake Iliamna. There's a new KTD on the Go essay from Aaron Kirkland, too. Shanna Sheehy's back next time with all this and more on Kids These Days, Tuesday at 2 and again at 7 here on listener-supported KSKA. We're back. This is Kids These Days. I'm Sarah Gonzalez. Shanna Sheehy is away this week. We're talking all about caregiver stress today on the program. Gary Barg, Francine Harbor, and Sandy Kearns are here talking with me today about this subject. Let's get back to our conversation. Right before the break, we heard a report from our contributor, Jessica Cochran, about how stress affects children, how it manifests in them specifically. And Sandy and Francine, you both work with families and children on a regular basis. Sandy, you at the Cancer Center at Providence, and Francine, you at NAMI, the National Alliance for Mental Health affiliate here in Anchorage. And in your work, how are you seeing stress affecting kids, and how might it be different than how it affects their parents, and how do you support children specifically?
Great. Well, I'd love to share just a little bit about the Susan Butcher Family Center at Providence Cancer Center. We have two primary goals in the Family Center, and that is to help children with resiliency and with empathy. So for these children that have a adult in their life newly diagnosed with cancer or living with cancer or bereaved from cancer, they are able to individually come into the center, and we provide a developmental model through 12 different learning centers in a multi-age classroom from birth to age 23 to address the stress and the family and school environment during this challenging time. There's no fee for these services. It was named in honor of the late Susan Butcher, who was a mother, battled cancer, and did pass away. And so we not only offer caregiving support groups for the adults and partners of adults in working with illness, but we also provide those individual and group services for their children.
Okay, and we'll be able to link to those services from our website at kidsthesedays.org. Francine, what did you want to add about how children deal with stress?
The children who are caregivers and the adults who are caregivers of the mentally ill don't have nearly that level of support. One thing that's different than almost every other illness in respect to mental illness or in comparison to mental illness is the horrible stigma that's attached to mental illness. And it keeps people in isolation and a sense of shame even more so than any other illness. So just to disagree a little bit with what Halit, the researcher, had to say, there is, she had mentioned, I think, that there it was difficult to generalize what child caregivers experienced, what needed to be assessed on a case-by-case basis. But children who are caregivers of the mentally ill universally, in NAMI's perspective, universally experience a sense of entrapment, mm-hmm. especially if they're the caregiver of, they're playing the role of the caregiver of the parent rather than the other siblings who may be the troublemakers or the silent ones. And it's this sense of entrapment that follows them into adulthood. And often the adults who are caring for either their young children or their adult children or their parents or siblings, they often feel this sense of entrapment too, mm-hmm. Because society just doesn't want to hear about it. They don't want to mm-hmm. hear about my schizophrenic brother. Mm-hmm. Whereas society has become progressive enough now that if you tell someone that my wife is suffering from colon cancer, there may be a little kind of ooey sense about it because it's colon cancer instead of maybe some other part of the body. But you can still go on to have a conversation about it. Mm-hmm. Whereas people, because I've experienced this time and time again when I've just been a public speaker, you start talking about mental illness, their mouth, the corners of their mouths turn down, and they've just become very stiff in their body, and the subject is almost taboo to talk about. Mm.
Gary Barg, in your work working with families who are caring for aging relatives, you know, we all know that the older population, they're faced with mental illnesses, and they're also faced with some, you know, cancer diagnoses and other kinds of health issues. It seems like it could be compounded in that caregiver situation. How do you support people who come into caregiving for an aging relative or parent and they're facing multiple diagnoses?
No, absolutely. And we deal with caregivers dealing with any issue. We look at the person who's doing the care, and there's a tremendous amount of similarities. When we have our Fearless Caregiver conferences, there'll be caregivers of people living with mental illness, and there'd be caregivers of kids with autism, there'd be caregivers of people whose loved ones have Alzheimer's. And actually the conversation on the kid caregivers is very, very timely. A friend of mine, Connie Siskowski, is the executive director of the American Association of Caregiving Youth, AACY, and we've been very involved with them. There's statistics show there are about a million and a half specific kid caregivers in this country, and that's why I like this conversation with Francine and Sandy, because it is true. There's, you have to put a, you know, framework around it for the government and organizations to step in and try to help. So the other aspect of caregiving that I think really needs some conversation is the 6 million grandparent and relative caregivers in the country. People have stepped in when that skip generation, you know, has stepped out. So now, what you talk about, the sandwich generation, I like to talk about sometimes the club sandwich generation. You might be caring for a grandchild, you know, a child, and a parent. So I don't want to be, you know, the olive in that sandwich, but that happens a whole lot with the caregivers we deal with.
Sure, and just to clarify, club sandwich would be like a four-decker generation. So you have your great-grandparents, your grandparents, your parents, and then your children.
I'm really glad you mentioned that, Gary, because in our line of work at the Cancer Center, we often have a mother caring for her adult child with cancer and then caring for the grandchild when that parent passes away. And so part of the family support and counseling that then takes place is not only grieving the loss of your adult child, but now assuming the responsibilities for bringing up your grandchild. And so they've not only have the loss issues, but this new responsibility and tremendous amount of stress, tremendous.
I'd like to ask about this part of the stress of being a caregiver. Does part of it come because it's just not the expected way of how someone imagines their family life going? No parent expects to have a child get sick and die. Or Gary, you came unexpectedly to caring for your parents. Maybe one parent has a mental breakdown. How do caregivers get beyond those expectations of a so-called normal family life? And is part of your work?
That's a brilliant question. Yeah, brilliant question. I really think that's the core of it. It's our expectations of normalcy in our own lives, and the fact that I always say you've gone through the looking glass. If you get the phone call in the middle of the night, there's some challenge with your loved one, you're through the looking glass, and on the other side is a tornado. That's caregiving. Mm-hmm. So the best thing to do is to reach out, is to not isolate yourself, is to join support groups, is to see other caregivers in action. And that actually helps maybe show you what Gail Sheehy says is a new normal.
Mm-hmm. Sandy?
I just absolutely agree with that, Gary. I can't tell you how often we hear the same comment, but this is not the life that I wanted. This is not what I expected. I was coming into retirement, and yes, I know that there's going to be illness and there's going to be challenges, but I really thought my latter years were going to be about RVing and some other ways of life. I didn't anticipate becoming a full-time caregiver. And so there is great sorrow and grief and resentment. And in support groups and in talking with others, one of the things we do not only is to validate those feelings, but to give permission to say what is not always appropriate to say. I'm angry. I resent this. I didn't want this. I want my old life back. And we don't normally say those kind of things in day-to-day conversations. We say, oh, yes, you know, yes, I'm there, and I would never leave my mother or never leave this person, and, oh, I'll never have more than I can bear. And in truth, people want to scream, and they want to shout, and they want somebody else to take this burden away, but they don't have permission to say that. And support groups and resources and call-in and chat lines, these are all really valuable resources that caregivers can tap into. At the Cancer Center, we try and offer daytime support groups, evening, Saturday, phone, and through email, because you never know when someone needs to be able to reach out.
We mentioned the sandwich generation and the club sandwich earlier, and we have a piece with a woman who's done extensive work on this subject and with this population. Millions of Americans are caring for aging parents as well as raising children at the same time. This group of people who are caring for family members on both ends of the age spectrum are called the sandwich generation. The work of journalist, writer, and speaker Carol Abaya has popularized this term. Since the 1990s, she has been supporting this specific demographic of caregivers by publishing a magazine, writing columns, and publicly speaking all over the country. I spoke with her about the unique challenges this growing group of Americans face. Hi, Carol. Thank you for speaking with Kids These Days.
How are you, Sarah?
Very well, thank you. So maybe you can just start off by telling us, what is the sandwich generation?
The sandwich generation are three-generation families where the adult child has the responsibility, either wholly or partly, for caring for aging parents and their own children.
How common is this in America today?
25 million families, and today, actually, the greatest section of the sandwich are the baby boomers, people who are now in their 60s and have parents in their 80s and 90s. so it's even a bigger segment than when I first became active in this area 20 years ago.
Okay. So you designed something called the Survival Course for the Sandwich Generation. Why did you design that? Why did you feel that there needed to be a survival course, and what is it?
Well, the survival course came about because I was thrown into the situation where very suddenly I had to take over the care of my elderly parents. My mother was 85 at the time. My father was 90. My mother got very ill suddenly, was in the hospital for 2 months, and I had to take over not only their care, but my mother's business. And I looked around for help for myself, and I saw there wasn't anything. So that's when I did start the magazine, which was published until 1998. And then I did a nationally syndicated column in papers across the country, and now I'm doing it on the internet newspaper, NewJerseyNewsroom.com. I say to people, I say, take several pieces of paper, start out with your parent or parents' name on the top, and divide it into two columns, and make a list of the things they can do for themselves and the things that they need help for. And then the things that they need help for, reach out into the family, see who's around, who can help do those some of those chores, or resources in the community where you can bring in help to help, whether it's volunteers from the church, whether it's some home care agency that can send in a person a couple of times a week, whether it's bringing somebody in to do the laundry and clean the house, whatever it is. You need to delegate and don't feel that you have to do everything yourself. For some reason, when we have kids, we have no qualms saying to friends, can Jamie stay at your house this afternoon because I want to go to the movies? For some reason, people are reluctant to ask for help for aging parents. I still haven't figured out why, unless it's they don't want to admit to people outside the family that the mother has dementia or Alzheimer's or the father doesn't know whether he's coming or going. I don't know. And if any of your listeners out there have an answer, I would love to hear it.
It seems like prioritizing would be so difficult when you're helping your elderly parents and also raising your children, and then you're also needing to take care of yourself.
Well, that's where that list comes in, where you make the list of what your parents can do, but then do the same kind of list for your children. What can they do for themselves? I mean, certainly if they're teenagers, they can keep their room clean. They can do their own laundry. They can help with the cooking even. I mean, I did that when I was a teenager. And if they're younger, again, there's still certain chores around the house or helping their grandparents do certain chores that can be delegated.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, you need to say, okay, I need time for myself. And you have to say to your family, okay, from 4 to 5 every day, I'm incommunicado. No one can talk to me. I'm going into my room, and I'm going to read, or I'm going to take a nap, or I'm going to watch television, and I don't want to hear about it from anyone.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to then also choose, you know, go out and spend time with your friends. If you have a hobby, continue it. Don't give it up because you have to take care of yourself.
Mm-hmm.
You can't leave the children out of the circle. It's not fair to anyone. And it's certainly not building any kind of family value care system that when you, the Sandwich Generation, gets old and needs help, if the children are brought up to see that family members take care of each other, then when you need help, they are hopefully are going to be there to do what you did for your parents.
Well, that seems like a good place to conclude. Carol Abaya from the Sandwich Generation, Thank you so much for joining us on Kids These Days.
My pleasure, Sarah, anytime.
That was Carol Abaya speaking with me from her office in New Jersey. You can learn more about her work with the Sandwich Generation and connect to her weekly columns by visiting our website at kidsthesedays.org. Gary Barg, Sandy Kearns, and Francine Harbor. They're all here with me in the studio today talking about caregiver stress. We just heard from Carol Abaya about the Sandwich Generation, those caregivers who are seeing to the well-being of two groups of people simultaneously, parents and children. And Carol, in the course of the interview, she asks if anyone knows why those caring for aging parents are less likely to ask for help than those caring for children. Gary, I want to direct that question to you. Do you have any ideas why that might be?
Sure. I go back to the original conversation we had about shame. There's a definite shame involved in having a caring for a parent with Alzheimer's or a senior loved one with Alzheimer's that there may not be if your husband has cancer and your daughter has cystic fibrosis. And part of that, and I want to say something. Part about that shame is for them. You don't want people to see them as you see them. You're protecting their legacy of who they were to everybody else. So everybody's memories of them is what they were as opposed to what they are. And I hear that all the time with family caregivers, is that shame isn't I'm ashamed, but I'm protecting the memories of them. And the other shame maybe is definitely I'm ashamed if I can't do it all myself. It's my job. It's my loved one. It's my husband or wife. It's my parent. So I think if there's any shame involved, there's those two elements.
Francine, do you have any thoughts about why that is? Why, I mean, you work with a population of families who have mentally ill family members, and it seems like shame would definitely figure in to that because there is such a stigma attached to mental illness.
Well, first I just want to agree with the whole concept of the sandwich generation with regard to mental illness. The way we describe it to our caregiving family members is that if the caregiving family member has a child, they can be in a position of laying down the law. You know, this is the way you tell Junior, this is the way it's going to be. You're going to go over to Aunt Susan's house for the afternoon because I'm going to do XYZ. But when it comes to taking care of your parents, it's a role reversal. You're not used to laying down the law for your parents. You know, they are the ones who used to do that for you. So how do you tell your parents, well, you're going to, this person from the church is going to come in and you know, play cards with you for the afternoon. I'm not going to do it with you because I need to go do something else. And that's the way it is. We're just not used to that role reversal. And the sense of shame comes in is that I'm challenging my parents' power. I'm telling them that I don't respect them as my elder anymore because I'm telling them what to do. And I'm ashamed of myself for doing that because that's not respectful of them and their position as an elder in society. So I think that's how the sense of shame comes in.
Is it possible to adjust to that role reversal and to get over that? Does that happen or is it just an ongoing struggle?
I think from a clinical standpoint that most families have what we call in the field unfinished business. There are very, very few, if any, perfect families, perfect childhood, and perfect family life situations. So you not only have your temperament, your development, your family history, and so you bring all of that to the table when you begin caregiving. And now you add that caregiving stress. So I think families muddle through the mm-hmm. best that they can, trying to do some of their own personal work, but some of that may not come until months or years down the road. But I think it's that interplay of personality and family dynamics. We are not a blank slate when we come to caring for someone else in the family.
Carol Abaya in the Sandwich Generation interview, she mentioned some practical tips that she tells caregivers to avail themselves of. And I want to talk about that to sort of close out the interview today. What are those practical tips that caregivers can do to care for themselves? She mentioned like sequestering yourself and saying, don't bother me.
Good luck with that.
Yeah. Making a two-column list, things that the person being cared for can do by themselves, things that they will need help with to sort of, sort it out. And delegating to relatives, hiring out services. Gary, in your Fearless Caregiver conferences, what kind of practical tips do you offer caregivers?
Remember your sense of humor. Mm-hmm. Carve time out for yourself. Create a sense of respite for yourself. Involve your loved ones. This goes back to the senior care as well as anything else. Make sure that you see that caring for yourself is job one for any family caregiver. And if, I just want to mention that we talked about Stanford University, too. Stanford University, the most insidious statistic that I've ever seen on family caregiver comes from Stanford University, that 40% of people with loved ones living with cognitive disorders will die before their loved ones do unless they manage their stress.
So, Sandy, in the support groups that you facilitate, it's called The Well.
The Well.
So, and that means a well of renewal and
yes.
sort of filling yourself up again.
Yes.
What do you tell the people in your support groups?
We also talk about share the care plans and bringing in different people to help support yourself and the family. We also talk about reaching out. And most importantly, I do want to say, reaching in. We do talk about taking care of yourself, but I specifically want to mention that sense of faith, that sense of hope, and that sense that we're going to be okay. And however you draw upon that, whether it's through a God of your own understanding, whether it's through nature, whether it's through music, or whether it's through art, it's not just the practical way you take care of yourself, it's that depthness. It is that well. It's how as an individual do we restore our own self so that we can continue to give to others.
And I think on that positive note, we'll wrap up this conversation today. It's all the time that we have for today on Kids These Days. And I want to thank my guests, Francine Harbor, Sandy Kearns, and Gary Barg, for joining us today to talk about this topic, caregiver stress. So thank you all for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Gary Barg joined us from Florida, where he publishes Today's Caregiver Magazine and Caregiver.com, as well as traveling the country with his Fearless Caregiver conferences. Francine Harbor is the president of the Anchorage affiliate of the National Alliance for Mental Health, providing support to caregivers of those with mentally ill family members. And Sandy Kearns manages the oncology support services at Providence, Alaska Medical Center, where she also oversees the Susan Butcher Family Center, and she co-founded the Well support groups for families facing a cancer diagnosis. Listeners, thank you for joining us today for this conversation about caregiver stress. You can find all of the organizations you've heard about today on our website. If you go right now to kidsthesedays.org, you can connect to all of these organizations. While you're there on kidsthesedays.org, you can leave your comments about this program and follow us on Facebook and Twitter, which we update all throughout the week. If you caught the tail end of this program or want to catch up on the last few programs you've missed, they're all there too on kidsthesedays.org. It's a great resource for fun stuff, so check it out. Up next time on the program, we're talking about the hunting and fishing family. The snow is gone, and that means it's open season for families to get out on boats and on four-wheelers for their annual hunting or fishing trips. What are the rules and regs for kids? And what growing up with a subsistence lifestyle means in today's modern world? All that and so much more. Join us next time. Shannon will be back in the host's chair. Kids These Days had help today from our regular contributor, Jessica Cochran. Host Shannon Sheehy also contributed to today's show. Our theme music is composed and performed by Lost Wheeler. I'm Sarah Gonzalez, and I'm this program's producer. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
The ideas, opinions, and commentary you hear on Kids These Days are those of the hosts, guests, and contributors, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of its funders or broadcast partners. The content producers is solely responsible for what you hear on the program. Kids These Days is made possible by a generous grant from the Association of Alaska School Boards and its Initiative for Community Engagement. Kids These Days is produced in partnership with KSKA 91.1 FM Anchorage, KRUA, and the UAA Department of Journalism and Public Communications.